You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Ted Neal. We talk about his shift from working in what he described as health organizations to becoming a full-time writer. So one of the things that I asked Ted about is, what does that mean that he worked in health organizations? Because I didn't know. I think it might actually surprise people that sometimes I have a part of the story that I'm going to talk to my guests about, but I also sometimes end up diving into the deep end of a story in an interview with just an itty bit of information. In this case, I did not know what it was that we were talking about, working for health organizations. And I dive in, and it works out to be a wonderful conversation. Ted's story is captivating. We talk about his work with children in global health organizations that took him to over 30 countries. We talk about his love for school. Those are my words, not his. And how he found his way back to his childhood dream of being a full-time writer and what that looks like today. So are you ready? I'm ready. Let's do it. Ted Neal, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. Are you ready for a fun chat?
I am.
I'm so excited to have this conversation with you today. I start all of my conversations asking my guests what part of the world you call home. So share with us, where are you?
I am in Seattle, Washington.
Ooh, I love it. What's the weather like today in Seattle? We're recording this in May, so it won't play for a couple of months, but what's the weather like?
It's actually beautiful. It is sunny. It's a little bit cool, so I'm wearing my fleece vest, which is kind of, de rigueur for the Pacific Northwest. But you know, we get a bad rap about the weather here. Corporate recruiters will tell you that Seattle's the hardest city to recruit people into. But once they get here, it's the hardest city to recruit people out of because we have beautiful weather. We just have some cloudy days, but it's gorgeous. Summers are amazing.
I have my youngest kid will be relocating to the Pacific Northwest for school next year. We've got a lot of conversations going on. I live in Miami, Florida, about how will the weather impact him. But he's very excited. So
it's not the weather as much. If he's come from Miami, it's going to be the darkness.
The gray is what everybody talks about. So
in the early nights, in the late sunrises. Yeah. That'll get them in November, December. If they can get through that, they'll be golden.
And we'll see. We're going to find out. We are going to find out if I get a middle of the year call like, hey, I need a weekend trip to San Diego. Because it's too far to come home for like a 24-hour trip all the way to Miami. So a Pacific sun infusion. All right. In a second, we're going to start the official interview, which is not about weather in the Pacific Northwest. I want to ask you one more warm-up question, which is, what's a way that you take care of yourself that you would consider self-care?
This is actually really easy for me. I get enough sleep.
Oh, I love that answer.
I feel like it's so basic and we forget it. And I've learned, especially in the past 12 or 13 years, just like my sleep hygiene. I didn't even know that term, sleep hygiene. But sleep hygiene is just, it's my basis for everything. It'll make it ensures that I have enough energy throughout the day to work, to play, to exercise. It's my foundation. So so that is my most important piece of self-care.
Do you have a really rigorous like nighttime routine that sets up when we talk about sleep hygiene? So sleep hygiene is like blackout shades, you only sleep in your bed, like the routine thing like that. Are you one of those people that has a real set nighttime routine to get you into the sleep position? And actually, follow-up question, legitimately, do you turn off your devices 2 hours before like everybody tells you to? Because I do not, I can't, that's a piece of it I struggle with.
I do not turn off my devices. But the notification, you know, it goes on quiet mode.
Okay.
Now that's set. But I also don't struggle with feeling too attached to my devices. Okay. Maybe I will in time, but right now that's not a challenge for me. I wouldn't say I am too stringent. I just make sure that I'm winding down by 9:30, and then I'm in bed by 9 or 9:30 and reading. That is my time set aside to read, and reading for an hour or so usually puts me right to sleep.
It's a pretty long time reading for an hour. Those are, so the sleep
Sometimes I
hygiene
don't last that
things.
long.
The sleep hygiene. I was recently at a I was at a luncheon a couple months ago, and there was a person. She was talking about how important it was, and I was agreeing with her. And she was young, and all of these things. And she's like, "So it's really important that you put all of your electric devices in a different room, and you turn them off 2 hours before you go to bed." And I looked around the table because it was a luncheon, and everybody was just kind of like not creating eye contact. Like we don't. We'll do anything but that. What are you gonna? I mean, 3 o'clock in the morning, if you wake up. There's nothing more soothing than, cat videos. Okay. Anyway, to get to the topic of the day, you made a big career shift at one point. And what you did is you went from working in health organizations, which I'm going to ask you questions about, to being a full-time writer. So to start with, tell us a little more about what that means that you are working for health organizations. Like, what is that? What does it mean? What were you doing?
Sure. It goes back to when I was in college. I started volunteering at a shelter for kids with HIV/AIDS in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And that really got me passionate about populations that are vulnerable to disease as a result of social stigma or socioeconomic status. And I thought that I would end up being a journalist focusing on these things. But as I started following these beats as a freelance journalist, I found that I was more interested in being more hands-on. And so I went and got my master's in public health. And that opened the door for me to work at different organizations like CARE, working in partnership with Save the Children and UNICEF, and allowed me to really see the world with a focus on maternal child health, child development, child protection, HIV/AIDS. And that sort of became my someone described the MPH, the Master's in Public Health, as kind of your plumber's card into international work. And that's really what it was for me.
All right. Okay. Very interesting. Now I understand a little bit more about what you were doing because I had a tiny piece of it from when you filled out your intake form, but now I have a bigger picture. If I was to have run into you when you were in high school or even middle school and asked you, what do you want to be when you grow up? What were your dreams as a kid for what you wanted to do?
I would have told you I wanted to be a writer.
Okay.
Even when I remember in primary school wanting to be a writer, it was only, and I thought I would go the quote unquote traditional route of being a journalist. And it was only in college that I started to get the feeling that the writers I liked the most were people who did other things. And they did things that gave them insight into different professions, different industries. And so I started kind of looking around, keeping an eye out for professions to go into that would allow me to see the world and gain experiences that would influence and inform my writing.
Very interesting. All right. So when you were a kid and you wanted to be a writer and then you went to study journalism, what did you think it meant to be a writer when you were a kid? What was your kid version of what that looked like?
Pretty much, well, traveling the world so you could see the world and you
Okay.
had something to write about, and sitting behind a desk and writing books.
I'm writing books, sorry. Yeah, versus essays or,
Oh, I mean, it could
anything.
be essays, it could be anything, but just it meant being able to sit down and have, yeah, it should be more specific. Being able to sit down and have that protective time to create. You know,
Okay.
an artist has to be in front of their canvas. A sculptor has to be in front of their block of stone. And for me, it would be that protected time to create, to write, whether that's by longhand with a first draft or polishing and refining on the keyboard.
And then there sounds like from a very young age, there was a connection to this that you wanted to travel and see different things all over. So was that always a part of your vision of yourself that this was a piece of what you wanted to do, travel and learn from experience?
It was. And I think partly it came from my father, who spent many of his formative years traveling the world. And I think I just had this assumption that that's what you did. You go around and see the world so you can learn about it and have something to say. And also recognize where you fit in the world. I couldn't have articulated it then, but I did have an inkling in high school, and definitely it became clearer in college. I knew I was from a very comfortable middle class background, and I knew that was not the real world, so to speak. That was not the experience of the majority of the people on this planet.
Sure.
And I felt like I needed to seek out experiences so I had a better idea, because I felt sheltered, and I knew I was sheltered.
Well, that's good awareness, but it's also, if there's anybody who's listening who's thinking, well, I mean, it's not necessarily, it's pretty much everybody is sheltered in some perspective, especially as children, because our culture is shaped so much by the adults who are around us. We're not really in charge at that point. And so you can only know what you know, which is why sometimes you end up as an adult having crazy conversations where people are like, well, what was it like to be a little kid where you were? And you're like, I don't know. It was the only thing I knew. Like, didn't have any other experience. So you go to DC and you begin to do volunteer work in, not volunteer work, like you were not planning fundraising parties for elementary school kids. You go straight into kids who are HIV positive. That was the work you were doing. How did you find your way to that? Did you look for it, or did it somebody introduce you to it?
I failed out of my Italian class.
Okay, there has to be more. Say more, say more. Those two
My
things don't sound like they're related.
father is a polyglot. He can just pick up on languages. And I'm terrible at languages, turns out. And I had enrolled in an intensive Italian course, and when I was at Georgetown, and I couldn't keep up. And so I had to drop out. But then to graduate on time, I had to somehow make up the credits, and they had a program at Georgetown where you could take you could do volunteer work that was connected to one of your courses. And I was taking a course in the literature and writings of the AIDS epidemic.
Okay.
And so what I found is if I volunteered down at the shelter for kids affected and infected with HIV, I could get extra credit, and that would still allow me to graduate on time. And that work really changed me. And I started off tutoring kids there, but it grew into just being kind of a mentor for them. And I was there for even after that. I didn't need to do it for credit anymore. I was volunteering there throughout my time in undergrad.
Okay, so for quite an experience. So you had been a little bit exposed. You can tell me how much you were exposed. So you were reading about literature along this topic, and then you began to volunteer with this community. What that highlights one of the things that I think is a really interesting difference that I like to point out, which is that we very much exalt and prioritize people who are experts through an academic channel, people who have studied a field. And we tend to sometimes minimize the importance of people who have actual life experience in the trenches, so to speak. So, what was the difference that you immediately discovered from going from reading literature about this situation to working with the community?
I think I would turn the question on its head a little bit, because the literature gave me insight, because it was by people, it wasn't primarily by people in the medical profession and
Okay.
academia. It was by people who just were quote unquote regular people who were living with HIV/AIDS, or in this case, in the early 90s, many of them dying, and kind of charting that course. And many people from the LGBTQ community. And this is a credit to the professor who designed the course, that she chose to maybe only keep 20% of the stuff we read was actually from the medical community. The
Okay.
rest was from kind of ordinary people. So when I entered this shelter down in downtown DC, working with these kids, that was actually, I'm like, okay, this is how it affects people as whole people, not just at not just say in the doctor patient dyad, or that very narrow perspective, but like I this is how it affects their whole life. What's the stigma they're encountering at school? Are there parents in their lives? What kind of issues are coming up for their parents? Can they not find housing because of their status? Are they having to keep their status hidden? Stuff like that. So in that regard, I felt like I was thrown into that aspect of it, of seeing people in their everyday lives, and not being stuck in the ivory tower of academia. I think that gave me a better perspective. This maybe would influence why I went into public health as opposed to medicine later on.
Yes. So you do the volunteer work while you're an undergrad, and you said you were working already freelance as a journalist, and you decide to go into to get a master's in public health. And how quickly did that turn into you working for these various organizations and getting to go around the globe?
Yeah, so the first 2 years after college, I was doing the whole thing of waiting tables and looking for freelance stories.
And this was in the mid-90s.
I graduated in 2000.
In 2000. So the journalism industry has already collapsed in on itself. Not a long list of people who are openly calling for hundreds and hundreds of new graduates.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was one of my challenges, was, trying to turn that actually into a real career. But I really was passionate about this beat of HIV/AIDS and how it affected marginalized communities. So I decided if I really wanted to understand it, I needed to go to sub-Saharan Africa. And I was able to find a Jesuit from Georgetown, who had moved to Kenya and founded a hospice slash home for kids with HIV/AIDS. And I figured I'd just try to go for the Peace Corps like experience. And I contacted him, like, hey, can I come and live and work there for 2 years? And he was up to his eyeballs in the needs of 100 kids who were sick. And he's like, sure. Initially, I went there and I thought that I would, living there, I'd be able to continue to write like as a freelance journalist or stringer, as we call them. But I quickly realized that was impossible. The needs of the kids were too much, and I really was getting a lot of, well, stress, but also fulfillment in terms of working with those kids. And the journalist piece felt impossible because, like you said, the industry was changing so much. And I didn't really have a mentor there. And also it was hard for me to stay objective.
Well,
And
that was going through my mind. You're almost the working the exact example that they used when I was in school myself of staying objective, which was not HIV, but was starvation in sub-Saharan Africa. Like, if you're reporting on a situation, where do you cross the line? Like, how do you stay objective and how do you avoid crossing the line? And, there's not an ideal situation there. There's not an ideal situation. So you're in it. This is not easy work that you were doing. This is big, heavy emotional lift. A lot of stuff. You were a scale of like 1 to 100. It sounds like you were about a 99 on the passion scale for the work you were involved in.
I'd say maybe even more.
But this sounds also like this is really nonprofit work. Were you just going almost like how were you how what was your quality of life as you were working for these organizations?
Yeah, and I realize I didn't completely answer your question. But so after those 2 years, I came back to US, and that's when I had that insight, like I needed to get the master's in public health.
Okay, so you go
So
back to school.
back to school, got that degree in 2 years. And so by 2007, after my time in graduate school, interning with CARE International, which had their headquarters in Atlanta, and I attended Emory in Atlanta for my MPH. I was basically able to enter that field full time.
Okay.
And so then the quality of life, I mean, well, I entered round two. I started interning at CARE in 2005, so just when I started grad school, and then I started working for them full time around 2007. And we all know what happened the very next year.
Yeah, you're right in the economic crisis. Yeah.
And so that made it very, very hard on nonprofits to really think about advancing your career, because hiring's frozen, and even if you do have a job, promotions were frozen, and so that made it tough, and it was very difficult. I was in my early 30s. A lot of my age peers were getting married, buying houses, and I was looking at my nonprofit salary and the perspective in terms of my career and realizing, oh, I don't think I can afford these things, a house, a family. And that was a real source of frustration, even depression for me at that time.
Yeah. I have a very good friend, and if you ask her why she went to grad school, she was like, "Well, I really wanted to be able to pay my electric bill and my car payment in the same month." It's looking for a slightly to level up. So I honor that answer because it's really hard. So like the nonprofit sector, your job prospects would have been heavily driven by their fundraising abilities and their grant rate, the grants they had. Nothing is guaranteed, even if the work you do is something that everybody thinks is important, children who need help, So, yeah.
Yeah, and I felt very passionate about it, and I felt like I was doing the right thing, but I still had some of my youthful idealism to wrestle with, because I had to realize it, and this is a hard lesson. You could do all the things right, and you could do all the right things, but you could still not be able to make ends meet.
Yeah.
And I think it revealed a little bit of my own sense of entitlement and expectations. I just had thought that, if I worked hard in school, and worked hard at work, that there would be career options for me.
Yeah.
And quickly realized that, oh, that's really not the case. And I could whine about saying, why me? But then a mentor said to me, well, why not you?
That,
You
yeah, that is the yes.
sat as a hospice aide next to kids dying of HIV/AIDS. You saw how unfair the world could be to them. Why do you think it's going to be fair to you?
Yeah, so right, when we plan a party and we plan a garden party, we rarely stop to consider if the forecast is going to be rain. When we have that vision of what's going to happen, we think about the sunny day and the ideal thing. It never flashes through our mind until we have to think about it, that we might have a cold or it might be overcast and rainy. There's like a human factor that most of us are thinking about the optimistic thing. And so many of us come up with this idea that if you work really hard, it should work out. And that is a bitter pill to swallow, that just because something is tough, sitting next to a kid who is going through a horrible experience, doesn't mean it's going to be well paid, doesn't going to mean it's being valued by somebody else, doesn't mean that you're going to want to do it forever.
Yes.
Yeah, it doesn't mean. So what were some of the things you loved about this job?
Well, I remember because I ended up going to business school, which I can get to that later. But one of the key things I learned in one of my business school classes is that what people look for in their jobs, other than material needs and like getting paid, they look for opportunities to be educated, they look for opportunities to socialize, and they look for meaning. And wasn't getting a lot. I was getting paid enough that I could get by, but man, I was learning so much. I was meeting incredible people, and I really felt that that job was meaningful.
Yeah.
And those and that re those things kept me going.
Those are really, really good things. So you did undergrad in journalism. You went back for a master's in health. At what point do you go to business school?
So while I was still at CARE in Atlanta, I was doing a lot of visits to projects throughout Asia and Africa. And one thing that kept coming up when I would be speaking with community members is they'd say things to the effect of, "Wow, this school that CARE has helped construct will be really helpful for our children. Or, wow, we really are glad this clinic is now available to us. But we also need jobs.
Yeah.
And when I looked around at our programs that were sustainable, they all had an economic component to them, whether it was microlending, social entrepreneurship, or just trying to find ways that people could access supply and value chains. And even though some of my friends from my public health school days were aghast, I started enrolling in MBA classes at Georgia State, which is literally across the street from CARE, because I realized if I really wanted to understand how to eliminate poverty, I had to know how to create value.
Yeah.
And I was blown away by all the amazing people I met in business school. These are not the corporate raiders I expected. They are people who wanted to change their communities, wanted to support their families. I really didn't run into a lot of the cutthroat type people, and so I started doing that on the side, and eventually in 2011, CARE did have a lot of layoffs and I got laid off, but Georgia State was gracious enough to give me a full scholarship. For the rest of my MBA, in light of my humanitarian work. And so then I was able to go forward with both those degrees informing each other. And the MBA also helped a lot because, no secret here, some nonprofits aren't that well managed.
Right.
And so having some of those tools from the private sector in my tool belt was useful for when I transitioned from CARE and then started working for other nonprofits.
That is, it's a very, not all companies are well managed. So, like, if you think about nonprofit organizations as being companies, you can put that under that big umbrella. But nonprofits do tend to get the spotlight for that. When you find a for-profit company, which is particularly not well managed, people are like, that's business, right? And then when the spotlight falls on people who have an altruistic mission, they tend to be a little bit more subject to public shame, in my experience. But it is true. It's not always the same group of people who are building these organizations. People who are building organizations that are altruistic often tend to be done just really very mission-based. And they're not the people. But business school, I love that you said that because many, many businesses start just with what you're talking about, which is like, how do we fix this problem? And the marriage, when it happens, and there's a marriage of business and service, sometimes it can do really, really beautiful things. Other times, not so much. So if I asked you if you like school, what would you say?
Oh yeah, I like school too much, and I'm done with school.
Well, there's
I
not much left you could do. You could go do a doctorate if you wanted in independent study, but you've done a lot of school.
yeah, and I really enjoy learning. But I've also realized that there's so much to be learned just from experience. I also had to recognize that school felt safe. School was always. Is very clear what the expectations were,
Yeah.
and I knew how to perform in a school setting, and to some extent it was more fair than some working environments. So I recognized that those are things I liked about school, but one of the reasons I didn't get a PhD because I did look into it was and the reason I went for the MBA is I wanted something practical. I wanted something that would allow me to get out into the world and do things. I didn't want to get stuck in academia. No offense to people in academia. We need them. We need them doing that work. But I just knew I was more interested in the practical application side of things. And I thought that the MBA would give me tools for that, especially when I was looking at things in relation to management and leadership, organizational development.
So now that you have a business degree, you've gotten laid off from CARE, you've got all these degrees. Are you still in the nonprofit world? At what point do you say, I cannot do this work anymore?
Well, all the time, all this time on the side, I was always writing.
Sure.
Ever since college, I was working on books, and I had at this point maybe five or six completed novels. And
Wow.
yeah, and on the side, I would be sending things off to traditional publishers or traditional agents, but hadn't gotten any. I got a few bites, but no one was like, we want to. we want to represent you and
No one wrote
let
to you and said, you are the next John Grisham. It's true.
Exactly. I did not get that letter. Got a lot of self-addressed stamped envelopes back saying we are not interested. So I actually continued with the international work until 2017, and I enjoyed it. I moved out here to Seattle in 2014 to work for World Vision, and they had me flying to Asia and Africa a lot. But in 2016, I started having some misgivings or second, I started reconsidering things because if you remember in 2016, that was the summer Philando Castile was shot by police.
Okay.
And there are a number of other police shootings. And I started looking around and recognizing there's a lot of problems here in the United States, whether it's health related, mental health related, social or racial justice, and started wondering if there's ways I could step into a role that was more domestic. It also coincided with me just getting older.
Yeah.
I was turning 40 around that time, and I found that my body did not bounce back from the long haul plane flights.
It's a shocking development of aging. Just sneaks right up on us. Everybody you know can tell you it's going to get harder. And then when it happens, you're like, darn it.
Yeah, I remember what I said about realizing how important sleep is
Yeah.
for just everything. And then I think the final piece of it was I was recognizing how important community was for me, and traveling is really getting in the way of building community here at home. So I really around 2016 started looking for my next move to be doing something still in the nonprofit space. Maybe I would go corporate and do something like corporate social responsibility. But I was starting to look at the things here in Seattle. But then something funny happened. In 2014, I'd given up on trying to go the traditional route, and I started publishing my books independently through Amazon Kindle Direct. And by 2017, I had six books on there, and they were selling. And
Nice.
yeah, and I suddenly recognized, I'm like, oh, maybe this is a viable route now. And so, in addition to kind of looking for jobs here in Seattle, I doubled down more on the writing and trying to get the next book out. And by 2017, 2018, it was clear I could do that for my full-time job.
All
And
right.
so
So I have a
I
follow-up question because I
sure.
talk to people who write books and want to write books and people who are dreaming of writing books, and there's a disconnect. There's a challenge because, like, writing the book and releasing the book, even if you do traditional publishing, you might have a dream that the publisher is going to find your audience for you, which and if you are self-publishing, you might wonder where the readers are coming from. Were you working on promotion? Did your business school like awareness? Were you working on publishing these books, or were people just organically finding you?
A little bit of both, but I could not have. I would not be able to negotiate to navigate being an independently published author today if I did not have my MBA.
Yeah.
It's a hat I still wear because as an indie author, you actually have to think of yourself as a publisher.
Yeah.
You're an independent publisher. You just also happen to be the talent,
By
but
the
you
way.
also. Yeah, but you also are the marketing department, and your management as well. So I have to manage, the editors, the graphic designers I hire. There's a whole ecosystem now to support independent publishing, and then of course there's the marketing too, because you don't have a traditional publishing house behind you to market your stuff.
Yeah.
So all that is, I have to wear my MBA hat for.
So very good. So you realize at this point that this is viable. It's like you can be your own supporter at this point. So when do you make the jump? How do you decide to make the jump, and what was the motivation?
Well, we get back to the fact that I always wanted to be a writer when I
Yep.
grew up. Like I said, I was around 40 this time. It felt like a good time to make the transition. I had been to 34 countries. I lived on three continents. Like I said, I didn't bounce back from those long flights, so the travel wasn't as wasn't a it was an itch I had scratched.
Right. It wasn't exciting anymore.
And it had given me so much, and it made me the person I was. But I was ready to kind of be in one place and be able to focus on writing. And like I said, it had always been the dream. So as much as I enjoyed my time in public health, it felt like the right time.
So, did it feel like you had done what you needed to do? Like, did it feel like it was you were able to close a chapter, or did you feel like you were skipping out early?
Great question. Because I guess in mission-driven work, you never feel like the job is done. I mean, there always seems to be another need. But I felt like I had done enough.
Okay.
When I checked in with myself, I felt like you're tapped out in this aspect.
And were you also experiencing burnout? Were you tapped out? Were you like, I can no longer sustain this level?
I wouldn't say I was burned out, but
Okay.
I would say it didn't bring me the same satisfaction it used to, especially because like the burden on my body, the burden on my community,
Yeah.
and this is where I feel a little self-conscious about talking about my writing career is that I'm 47 and I'm still single. I don't have kids, and I know a lot of that was due to the fact that for many years, it was like I had two jobs. I was working for 40, 50 hours a week, and then evening and weekends I was pursuing my dream of being a writer. And
Yeah.
that can cut into and also if you're traveling around the world a lot, it can cut into your social life. And becoming a writer I had to make some sacrifices for it. And I know people don't always want to hear that. They want to hear that they can have it all. But I think maybe we could have it all, but not at all at the same time.
That's funny because that was what was bouncing around in my head. I got that from Oprah back in the day. It's like maybe you can have it all, just not at the same time. And there are times where in my life, which and I'm the opposite of you. I have a big family with lots of kids. But there were several notable times where people would like say, "Hey, let's look at your life and see exactly how much time you have to be working on these things." And the answer was none. Answer was the small army of people that I had created were keeping me very, very busy, and there wasn't a lot of time to work on those things, which is that's where you make the choice. It's like, do you want to juggle so that you can lean into it or not? And that's what I hear you saying. It's like, if I wanted to go for this, this was the time where I would make this sacrifice.
The compensation I had was that I was working with kids,
Yeah.
and I was still in touch with many of those young people who I'd known at the orphanage, and I came there just as we were, just as antiretrovirals were coming on the scene. Like when I got to that orphanage in 2002, we were losing 2 to 3 kids a month.
Yeah.
By the time I left, thanks to antiretrovirals, we were only losing 2 to 3 a year.
It really is in the field of public health, and I'm not involved in it at all, but I think about what the headlines were in when I was in high school in the 80s and then today, what a profound transformation.
But those kids still didn't have families. And
Yeah.
so those of us who grew up with them, in quotes, I end up being kind of a surrogate dad or brother to many of them. I put six of them through college. And thanks to social media, I can follow their lives. My book I published this year, I couldn't have done if I still wasn't close to them. Because it was a follow-up with many of them after 20 years. So even though I didn't have my own kids, it's not that I lacked for having children in my life and that sense of family. It just didn't look like
Yeah.
something traditional.
So when I was naming this show, people initially, when I talked to people, they were like, "Do you mean parents?" And I was like, "No, I don't." I was like, "I am a parent, but I was like, I think that we segment the adult population into parents and non-parents, and we do like a huge disservice because there are all these things that like impact just adults in general, Right. And it's a big conversation. Do you have kids or do you not have kids? It's a huge number of people who choose to not raise their own children. And I was like, no, I'm adults, not just parents, adults, all the
Appreciate
adults.
that.
Yeah, no, because yeah, right, exactly. Like, I mean, it's like you, yeah, 100%. Okay, so yeah, you make this decision and you say that this is a journey of rediscovering your voice, confronting past trauma, and learning to embrace the messy, non-linear path of personal reinvention. Those are your words, not mine. Tell me more about what that means, like personal reinvention, the non-linear path. This is what we're talking about, I guess, your writing here.
Yeah, that's what I've used to describe my nonfiction writing.
Okay.
I have 8 nonfiction books now. I have something in the teens for the fiction, but yeah. So as you might have gathered from what I hinted at around the time I was laid off from Fair in 2012. 2011, that time, with all the changes going on, the frustrations of my life, I became very, very depressed, and I was even hospitalized for depression, which I always quickly follow up and say to people when I share that, is like it was the best worst thing that ever happened to me, because I had been carrying around a lot of grief from those 2 years, and maybe even big T trauma from those 2 years at the orphanage. You bury enough children that you taught how to walk and talk. That leaves a mark on you. And
Yeah.
as it turns out, refugee camps, war zones, and urban slums, not the best places to work through your trauma for the next few years, which is basically what I was doing.
Shocker that. Like, so
Yes, so
it
getting.
is actually, that's a weird thing because it's one of the things is like you're drawn to the things that your wounds have imprinted on you, but it's also not always therapeutic to be in those spaces.
Yeah, and I think the other reason sick, vulnerable kids, or kids who had lost their parents, that cause resonated with me is my mom had breast cancer when I was 3 and a half. I'm very lucky I did not lose her. She's a survivor. She's 82 today, and
Happy
still
birthday, Mom.
feisty. Yeah, this is her birthday month. But I kind of had looked into that abyss at an early age. Of what it would be like to lose a parent. So when you said that our trauma is big T or little T, then imprint on us. Yeah, they do dictate a lot of the choices we make. And I think that's what led me to working with those kids. I could have worked at a hospital that was working with men with gay men with AIDS. I could have, there's a lot of other volunteer work I could have done. When I was in college and looking at those options, it would tie into that English course. But I chose children. But yeah, so jumping forward to 2011, 2012, that's when I've been laid off from care. I was at Georgia State and really depressed and hospitalized for depression. And it gave me an opportunity to look back at the past couple of years, and part of that healing process was to give shape to what I had been through, and that's when I started writing that first memoir, 2 Years of Wonder, that was about my time there. And even in that memoir, I jumped around a lot, comparing my jumping back and forth between my experience there, in the home, my work trying to reconcile it. At that point, it was about 10 years later. And how I was trying to bring all that together. And so in that sense, it was very nonlinear. And I think so much of our healing journey tends to be iterative
Yeah.
as opposed to linear. And so I think that's probably why when I describe my work that way, that's why that comes up that way.
So before we hit record, we had a slightly very, very brief conversation about and I think the word you used was replicable. Like, was your career path replicable and would, in the context of helpful for other people? And I think that one of the just huge cons of modern adulthood is that we still, many of us have this concept that that forward progress and being an adult and getting to success and happiness is supposed to be linear. And one of the things that fascinates me is I know very few people. I do know some that their path absolutely was, go to college, get the degree, get the job, buy the house, put a stamp on it. We're happy things go through. I know many, many more people who their path is much more like the cha-cha and the tango and, a little bit of salsa and merengue in between. Two steps forward, step to the right, step to the left, a little bit of repeat, change the song and try again. And so I think that what you said about your pause for recovery is really, really helpful in the thing that you said. It gave you a container to be able to figure out where it belonged and how to do that, how to where it belonged in the story. And that sort of context is really helpful. And I'm glad that you got that. I really am.
Yeah, I like your dance metaphor. What I had thought of my career as up till now is definitely hasn't been a career ladder.
Right.
It's been more like a climbing wall. And I like saying climbing wall because there's a lot of lateral movements on a climbing wall, and
Yeah.
you're much more likely to fall off a climbing wall, which I feel.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, it could be like a ladder if it was like sort of like a staircase if it was like one of those Escher and like designs where they're like all going all in the, four dimensional in every single different way. But yeah, I think that that's, and part of that is I have my own experience. I have the kids. I see my parents, all of those things. And, I know some people who have very, very linear paths and it works. And I just know so many other people who it's not linear. And then they find themselves turning that lens back on themselves, like, does this mean I've done something wrong? And some, I just think that giving yourself permission to go back to school, change it up, do what needs to be done to recenter and try the next thing, I think that's helpful. All right, so we're gonna get to the final fun questions in a section, but I want to give you a chance to really talk about your books that you've written and how people can find them and find you after we finish this conversation. I think you said you've written 30 books. Is that where you are with this?
Yes, it's around that many now. But I probably have to, put some conditions on that to explain how it makes sense.
All right, so tell us about the books you write and how people can find you.
So it actually is very emblematic because you talked about being able to pause and look back and try different things. Like my writing reflects that. Even my writing is not such as been just in one genre. I write for all audiences and age groups. I have a series of books for young adults. I'm sorry, a series of books for middle grade readers called Mystery Force. This is a illustrated series I do with an artist. These are shorter books. I wrote all nine of them in just 1 month. So that's how I got nine books
Okay.
because they're shorter. And I do them with an illustrator. They feature a cast of protagonists who are children with disabilities. And the genesis of this project came because of my friend who uses a motorized wheelchair and has an animal companion, a little yellow lab, approaching one day. She's like, "Ted, there need to be more books for kids with disabilities where they can see themselves as heroes."
Yeah.
So that's what Mystery Force is. I have a number of young adult series that are fantasy, sci-fi, and a mixture of both. And then I have a couple adult sci-fi series. And then when it gets to my nonfiction, I have my memoirs about my time in Kenya, one I mentioned, 2 Years of Wonder. I this year published a follow-up to that called 20 Years of Unraveling.
Okay.
And that came about when some of the young people who grew up at the orphanage approached me in 2020 and disclosed to me that they had been sexually abused for almost 20 years, that had been going on at the orphanage and had been covered up. Most of the abuse had been done by members of the Catholic clergy and had been covered up by members of the church. And so we went on a 3-year odyssey to get their story heard. It involved the FBI and involved the Washington Post doing an investigation. And so that follow-up book is about the journey we went on together.
Wow, you're very the it reminds me of the movie is called Spotlight, but the story they tell is the Boston Globe doing the investigation in the late 80s and 90s.
Yeah,
Yeah.
when I was working with the Post, the reporter I was working with, she was Kenyan. She worked at the Washington Post. Her editor said, "Go watch Spotlight." because you're
Yeah, that's a, it's a, it's, if you're a fan, it's a fun movie if you had dreams of being a newspaper reporter as a student. Yes.
it, and it was full circle for me because I was actually part of a investigation by a major newspaper into a big story. So like, oh, I do get to wear a journalist hat now.
Yeah.
So, and then one of the things I learned while I was in the hospital for treating my depression is I encountered the recovery community for the first time. And I mean, I have some family members who have been members of AA or NA, and so I always had a lot of respect for that community, but I'd never, and I'm not part of it in the sense that I'm not an addict or alcoholic, but man, I love their 12-step philosophy and I love their spirituality. And I used a lot of that for one, my own healing. But then throughout 2016 to about 2022, I was doing a lot of racial equity work. And I started using kind of a 12-step framework to approach racial biases. And so that's where my other nonfiction series, My Name is Ted and I'm a Racist,
Okay.
comes from.
Sorry. That's very funny. That's a very good, it's a very good headline. It's wildly inappropriate for me to laugh at that title, but very funny.
No, I chose it because it gets reactions. But taking a page from the 12-step community,
Yeah.
who embrace their imperfection as the first step in their healing journey, I thought that if we're really confronting our divisions within ourselves, divisions within society, we needed to say, "Hey, I'm Ted and I'm a racist," or "I'm biased against these people or that people." And really try to lean more into compassion. And so that's what that four book series, they're shorter books, but it's a four book series kind of how-to manual of to wrestle with those issues. And they follow my own trajectory as someone who started as a very strident activist in that space to someone who now is, I'll put it this way, I started off wanting to be a knife and cut people up into different and divide them up and say, you belong this category, you belong that category. And I was, backing up a dump truck of assumptions about people, just dumping all these assumptions on them. And the longer I did the work, the more I realized I was getting away from the principles of compassion. And so now I try to be medicine. So I moved from being a scalpel to being medicine. And those four books kind of track that trajectory, which I think a lot of people will relate to as we try whatever cause we're trying to advocate for.
Yeah, it's been really interesting in the last 10 years to see like the sort of meta research, which is about what is it in the 12-step programs that works, because it's been pieces of it have been replicated in all kind of different things, and it's wild to see, the value of creating a community of people who are helping you move forward in a goal, getting clarity on what you're trying to do, removing obstacles, being honest with yourself, looking for help, those kind of things. Because it's like it's there it, very, very passionate emotions on all sides of that. People who are like, this is what works and it just works, don't question it. And then other people are like, no, it never works. You shouldn't do that. You should do something else. And then luckily, there's a few people who are like, let's figure out what parts of this might work and if we can put it in other places. So I love that. All right. What is where can people find you? They look it up on Amazon, and where do you want people to connect with you?
Yeah, all my books are on Amazon, and right now I'm exclusively on Amazon, but I'm going to be expanding to Barnes and Noble and Kobo and a couple other platforms in the next few weeks, probably by the time that this drops. And I go back and forth in terms of being exclusive to Amazon or not. It's just because they offer promotions. You can find me on social media. On Instagram, my handle is The Real Author Ted Neal.
Okay.
Find me on TikTok. On BookTok under Ted Neal Writes,
Okay.
and you can find me on Facebook. And I'm pretty much I'm on Tumblr, I'm on Substack, I'm on Reddit. You can find me just about anywhere. I'm very open. Try to put myself everywhere. I'm not on Blue Sky and not on X, so
There
you'll
you go.
probably find other stuff.
So I will include the links for that in the show notes, and people can follow that. And the easiest way to get that is to be a subscriber to the Imperfect Adulting email community, because then I send that direct to your email box. You can click on it and connect with Ted and order these amazing books. Now, Ted, are you ready for the final three questions? Rapid fire, just for fun.
I'm ready.
All right. I
The
didn't know
whole
you.
thing's been fun, Amy.
Thank you. I didn't know you were in Seattle when I came up with this first question. Do you prefer, but I don't know if it's going to impact your answer because you've been all over the world. Do you prefer coffee, tea, or something else?
Oh, coffee.
Okay, so you just earned your Seattle card right back. So there you go. All right, very good. All right, do you have a favorite band or musical artist, and are you willing to share with us who it is?
Growing up, it was U2. I know that some people consider that cringe nowadays,
Nah, what? Not fair. Not here.
but I, lately I've come to really enjoy Atlas Genius.
Oh, yeah.
Atlas Genius and Odessa. Those have been on my playlist a lot.
One of my kids has an Odessa tattoo.
I feel so hip now.
There you go. There you go. There you go.
Tell your kid thank you. You made an old man feel hip.
If it was a rainy day and you've got plenty of them in Seattle, but you have no obligations, nothing to do, no deadlines, what would I find you doing? Would you be on the couch reading a book of your own? Would you be watching TV, binging a series? Would you be doing something like a puzzle or a craft or something else?
Not the puzzle of the craft. I don't like puzzles. My parents loved them growing up. I never got into them. But I would either be reading on the couch in front of the fire with my dog, or I would be working on some writing. And hey, there's no such thing as bad weather, only bad gear. So I might be out hiking as well.
There you go. All right. Very nice. That's it, Ted Neal. Thank you for being an amazing guest today on the show.
Thank you. It's been a great time.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again. Please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adultier adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.